From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. The United States Director of National Intelligence is pushing back on skepticism of alleged Russian hacking in the U.S. election. Without mentioning him by name, James Clapper appeared to criticize President-elect Donald Trump today in his testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee, saying policymakers should always be skeptical.
But I think there's a difference between skepticism and disparagement.
Well, joining us now with more is NPR's congressional reporter Scott Detrow. Hi there, Scott.
Hey there.
So, first of all, Clapper wouldn't say much about some specifics of a review that was ordered by the Obama administration back in November, but he did say that it's done and that an unclassified version will be released next week. So, based on what intelligence officials did say today, could we glean anything about what's in their investigation?
A little bit. Clapper and the other officials who testified did mostly stick to the broad statements that we saw come out from the Intelligence Committee, you know, in October and a couple times since then, saying he wants to stick to previous public statements now. We're going to see more details of this next week. He does remain confident, in fact, more confident that Russia was involved in this hacking, that they did carry out these operations with the goal of influencing the election, and that this was something that was authorized at the highest levels of Russian government. There was one new thing that Clapper said today that was interesting. He said this was a multifaceted campaign, and here's a quote, "The hacking was only one part of it. It also entailed classical propaganda, disinformation, and fake news." So that's going to be something to look for when this report comes out next week. I think the big question now is how much of this report people like you and me we'll get to actually read, because a lot of this information is classified. But Clapper said he's going to push aggressively to unclassify as much of it as possible, because with all the politicization around this, he wants to have a lot of specific evidence out in the public view.
OK, so we'll talk more about American cybersecurity in just a moment, because, of course, that was the, you know, a major issue in today's testimony. But let's just jump to straight to the relationship between President-elect Donald Trump and the intelligence community, because that did come up today. I mean, on Twitter, the president-elect cited WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange today, once again casting doubt on intelligence reports about Russian hacking. But then he also tweeted that he's, quote, a fan of, quote, intelligence. I mean, what did senators and intelligence officials in today's testimony have to say about the relationship between the next president and the intelligence community?
It came up a lot, and I would say that Democrats were very blunt about it, specifically talking about their concerns about Donald Trump's criticism of the intelligence community, trashing the intelligence community. That's how Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill put it. With Republicans, it was clear they were talking about Trump, but it was you kind of had to infer it. There was one exchange that John McCain had with Clapper where he said, "I want to talk about Julian Assange," and said that, you know, is it correct that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have released information that has put American operatives in harm's way? Clapper said that's the case. Yes. And McCain said, if that's so, should we give him any credibility at all? And Clapper said, you know, I don't think so. You know, this coming a day after President-elect Trump is tweeting quotes from Julian Assange seemingly approvingly, I think that was very clearly a rebuke from both men to the president-elect, who's embracing Julian Assange, but stiff-arming the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. Of course, Clapper and other intelligence officials will be meeting with Trump in person tomorrow.
Well, let's hear a little bit more of what Senator McCain had to say. He's the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and here's a comment from him about the United States and its comprehensive or lack of comprehensive cybersecurity strategy.
This appearance of weakness has been provocative to our adversaries, who have attacked us again and again with growing severity. Unless we demonstrate that the costs of attacking the United States outweigh the perceived benefits, these cyber attacks will only grow.
Did the intelligence officials shed any more light about cybersecurity efforts underway in the U.S. or for the U.S. government?
Well, this hasn't just been Russia. I mean, there have been several instances of this. There was high-profile Chinese espionage in terms of getting into government systems a few years ago. There was, of course, that North Korean incident where they hacked into Sony and released thousands and thousands of reams of private information and private emails in response to a movie they didn't like. So this has been happening, and this has been escalating, and there was a lot of worry and criticism from all a lot of the senators on the panel saying that the United States needs a clearer strategy on this. One thing that Clapper did say is that, it's tough to have deterrence when it comes to cyber warfare as opposed to nuclear warfare, because this is very nebulous and it's not clear. Every cyber attack can be different. Every countermeasure can be different. And it's tough for two countries to eye each other up and say, well, it's not worth doing X because you'll do Y like you can in conventional warfare.
Well, that's Scott Detrow, NPR's congressional reporter. Scott, many thanks.
Thank you.
In Iraq today, a car bomb tore through a Baghdad market, killing at least 11 people. ISIS has managed to carry out a number of attacks like this, while at the same time putting up stiff resistance in the northern city of Mosul. ISIS has held that city since 2014. New York Times photographer Tyler Hicks is just back from spending 3 weeks with Iraqi forces fighting to retake Mosul. There's a link to his story and his photographs at hereandnow.org. And Tyler Hicks joins us now via Skype from New York. Tyler, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, your photos, as always, are absolutely incredible. The very first one in your story shows this massive fire that was set by ISIS in the oil fields just south of Mosul. And you write that this is actually part of ISIS's strategy as they retreat from places. So can you tell us more about that? What did you see in terms of ISIS in retreat?
This has been going on there for months, these incredible fires, which they set the oil wells on fire to provide cover while fleeing from Iraqi forces and providing cover from American airstrikes. This creates, as you can imagine, incredible amount of pollutant. It's hazardous to health, and it creates even another layer of a reason why people have to flee their homes, which is something less obvious than the immediate war bombs and gun battles that force people to have to flee their homes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in your photos, you have these very striking images of residents in Mosul huddling. You know, they're waiting for assistance, for food and water. There's pictures of family members running down streets, one with an Iraqi soldier protecting them. But of course, the common theme is that everything around them is utterly devastated. I mean, what is life like for civilians caught in these battles?
What struck me there is that there's really very little sense of security anywhere. And the thing about photographing war over many years is that you just never know what to expect. And that's what the civilian population, I think, has also grown up with. This becomes, in a way, normal to them, part of their everyday life. But even as Islamic State fighters are pushed out of these areas, they can pop up anywhere. They have very sophisticated networks of underground tunnels and the ability to move around and come up without any warning. And this is a very difficult way for people to live. And you can see it in their body language. You can see how people are always poised, always it's a very different silhouette than you're used to seeing in peaceful places.
Hmm. Well, you know, when I introduced you, I said that you were back from 3 weeks on the front lines of this offensive. But then I remembered that you close your piece by saying that this is still a very dangerous and shifting fight and a shifting front line. I mean, is there any kind of dividing front line in the fight for Mosul?
When you are especially dealing with a fight in a large urban area like this, there very often isn't a front line. This is street to street and block to block fighting. It's a patchwork of very complicated areas that can be very porous. So that's what makes these places so dangerous and gives the Iraqi forces such a challenge. And they really are facing a huge challenge, one that I think is going to be a battle that takes a very, very long time and continues to cause a lot of casualties, both military and civilian.
Well, of course, there's enormous danger for civilians and members of the military and police, as you're saying, who are in this battle. But I'm wondering about what this latest embedded experience was like for you. Was it different than other war zones that you've been in? Was there anything that strikes you about Mosul that felt different than other places?
Absolutely. And one thing that really struck me is that there's not a huge amount of organization in the beginning of this. And I have colleagues, other photographers, journalists who were on the initial push of this operation with Iraqi forces. Very quickly, one of the New York Times photographers, Brian Denton, was injured when a suicide car bomb detonated close to him, and also injuring some Iraqi soldiers. It's also these kind of things which understandably make access more difficult. In fact, there are no foreign journalists officially permitted to be embedded with them on their push at this time.
Well, Tyler Hicks is a photographer and reporter for The New York Times. We've got a link to his story and his photographs from Mosul. That link is at hereandnow.org. Tyler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
2 months ago, President Obama and President-elect Trump met face-to-face for the first time. They came out of the meeting saying all went well and talking of a smooth transition of power. So far, you might not call things smooth, but this is hardly the most fraught transition we've seen between U.S. presidents. For that lesson from history, we turn to Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow. They co-host the weekly public radio show and podcast Backstory. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with them both, and he started by asking Brian what happened in 1933 when Franklin Roosevelt took the keys from Herbert Hoover.
Well, what happened then is they hated each other, basically, and they didn't pretend very much not to hate each other. The perhaps low point in the transition came when they were forced to sit in an open-air car on the way to the inauguration, and they sat there in stony silence.
And remind us why. We were in the midst of a financial crisis in this country.
We were in a terrible financial crisis, and the two men had very different ideological positions on how to deal with it. The real breaking point between the two of them was direct assistance from the national government to individuals. Roosevelt had already done that in the state of New York, and he felt it was the federal government's obligation to reach out and help people, the millions of Americans that were unemployed. Hoover felt that this would lead to dependency, government overreach, too much bureaucracy, and eventually either fascism or some form of socialism.
Well, not unlike Trump, FDR at the time offered a very different vision than Hoover did about the best way forward for the country, as you kind of laid out there. Here was Roosevelt in his inaugural address in 1933.
This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper.
So you hear that from 1933. It could be read as taking a dig at Hoover, I guess, in a way. But we should also remember that this is a time when inaugurations happened in March. So these two presidents, these two guys, had a lot of time to meet with each other. In fact, they met three times. Did FDR ever take any advice from Hoover?
No. He was relatively polite in those meetings with Hoover. But the fact of the matter is the two men had fundamental differences on what government should do. But just as importantly, you referred to the dig really was Hoover's whole approach to the crash and then the stock market crash and then the ensuing depression was denial. It's going to get better. You know, we're in a bad cycle here. And that dig you referred to in that great clip you played is Roosevelt saying, look, we can't deny this anymore. We need to acknowledge this and then take bold action to deal with it. And Roosevelt did.
That, in fact, Hoover was not telling the truth in the eyes of FDR. Kind of that hurts a little bit. Ed, why don't you take us further back? Because there have been transitions in this country when we were at the brink of war. I'm thinking 1861, Abraham Lincoln takes over for James Buchanan.
Yeah, I mean, you know, direct assistance to citizens in need is big stuff, but it's not fight over the future of slavery and over the future of the nation. I mean, if you want to see the most fraught transition in American history, it's just the one that you said, Peter, between Buchanan and Lincoln.
Talk about setting up your successor for failure. In Buchanan's final address to Congress, he said Southern states had no legal right to secede from the Union. And he also said, on the other hand, the federal government doesn't really have much it can do to stop that from happening. What do you think was going on there? Was he trying to create disorder for Lincoln, or was he just done with the job?
Well, he'd been creating disorder throughout his entire presidency. You know, he's the second oldest man ever elected to the presidency. He announced in his inaugural address that he was only going to serve one term. His entire purpose was to put the nation back together again. But he was so pro-Southern. He was basically incapable of imagining the South buckling under to the greater purpose. And so he was not willing to do anything. So here's the thing. Things were bad in the Great Depression. But imagine that six states had seceded from the country by the time that you showed up for your inaugural address, and eight others are considering it. That's the situation that Lincoln faced.
Yeah. Let's go back even further than this now, because there were times when presidents have tried to sabotage, maybe that's a strong word, but at least undermine the goals of the incoming president. There was the story of the Midnight Judges with John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, right?
Yeah, you know, back in the very beginning of the nation, when it wasn't clear what the norms everybody talks about today really were. And so John Adams, disgusted with the threat that he believed that Jefferson and his party presented to the United States, decided that he would fill the judiciary with judges across the country who would basically perpetuate the Federalist policies that Adams had stood for and be a bulwark against whatever Democratic mischief that Thomas Jefferson had in mind.
All right. Well, let's shift to something else, and that is the relationship between President-elect Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. We've heard so much about this. Trump has called for closer ties between the two countries, much to the chagrin to many people in his own party, even. He was skeptical of the Obama administration's claim that Russia was behind the election hacks on the DNC. Putin has been complimentary of Trump. He even sent the president-elect a Christmas card. But Brian, this is not the first time an American leader has had a controversially cozy relationship with Russia.
No, there have been bromances before and bromances during really difficult times. And we go back to Franklin Roosevelt really arguing that for geopolitical reasons, in order to balance the growing power of Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, the United States needed to have good relations with the Soviet Union. And Roosevelt was a supremely confident kind of guy. Hmm. He felt that he himself could charm this brutal dictator, Stalin.
He even called him Uncle Joe. but FDR got a lot of criticism for that because people said that Stalin was the one who, in fact, had the upper hand in that relationship. And how do historians judge FDR's role in helping to prop up what would actually set the stage years down the road for major conflicts between the West and Russia?
Well, I think if you skip right to the Cold War in the early 1950s, late 1940s that you're referring to, you can see it perhaps as the Soviet Union getting the upper hand, giving away Eastern Europe, as it was said, after World War II. To do that would be to forget the colossal sacrifices that the Soviet Union made during World War II. Millions and millions of soldiers, millions and millions of Russian civilians that were killed at the hands of the Nazis. And it doesn't take a huge imagination to understand that if those weren't Soviet lives, some of them might have been American lives.
Well, Ed, let's go back just a little bit deeper than that again. What other uncomfortable relationships can you recall between presidents and other controversial countries?
Well, the greatest bromance of all would have to be with the Marquis de Lafayette, apparently a very lovable guy. Everybody thought highly of him. He'd helped win the American Revolution. And even though he was exiled in his own native France, we brought him to the United States and marched him all over the country. And as a reward, because he was broke, we gave him $200,000 in a part of Florida. So,
and named a lot of squares after him, as far as I can recall.
So there's a case, you know, where the conflict, now this is hard for us to imagine today when we think about Russia or China being the great powers, but of course then it was England and France. Mm-hmm. And if Thomas Jefferson was a huge fan of Lafayette, whom he hosted in his home, and in between drinking French wines and eating French foods and all that, well, the alternative then must have been John Adams, to pick on him again, must have been an Anglophile. Now, he wasn't really, he didn't really like anybody, but he liked the English better than he did the French. And so, as funny as that seems to us now, at the time, it was of enormous global consequence. Was the United States more like France in the wake of its revolution, or is it more like England, the great power of the world that we had fought a revolution?
What is our future going to look like?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we have to exercise historical imagination to put ourselves back in a position which something that seems like, well, which part of Europe do you want to visit on your easiest trip now?
Peter, I think one of the things we learn from these close relationships, they're always seen as, you know, matters of personalities, hitting it off. I looked into his eyes and I saw this and that. They're usually very important diplomatic objectives, at least in the minds of the presidents who are pursuing it. For Roosevelt, it was balancing world power, basically, whatever kind of guy Stalin was. I mean, to go to Donald Trump, my guess is if we brought him into this conversation, he'd say, look, Putin can be a very useful ally in fighting Islamic terrorism. Now, you might agree with that or disagree with it, but I think it's important to look underneath the personalities and at least credit the possibility that these presidents might have larger diplomatic objectives in mind.
Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers co-host the weekly public radio show and podcast Backstory. Does your boss know how to do your job? New research in Harvard Business Review finds that employees who answer yes to that question, that their boss does know how to do the tasks they do, report greater job satisfaction. In other words, it's not enough for a boss to have good leadership skills or a good personality. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, thank you for coming in.
You got it.
So, Kurt, the study is not downgrading those attributes, managerial and organizational skills. They say they do matter, but what is it exactly the study finds counts even more?
Well, it counts a lot when your boss can do your job. It's not clear exactly why, because it could be that you might be happier knowing that if you had to leave suddenly, that your boss could jump in and do it for you. But maybe it's just the fact that they understand what the work entails, and so they have a realistic set of expectations for you, and that ends up making you happier at work. And happiness at work is shown through studies to lead to higher performance, too.
Of course, some people would be happy knowing that nobody could do their job except for them.
Yeah, right.
But give us an example of what the study proved.
Well, software, I think, is an example of something where if a coder knows that his or her boss can do that job, that they end up having higher expectations or higher satisfaction in their jobs just knowing that their boss can do it. And you can take this up and down the line to other industries too. It's been shown before that in the NBA, players who are all-stars, who turn coaches, are more successful. So it could be the fact that people in these jobs know that their boss understands what they do. Maybe they just have respect for their bosses because their boss has been there before, and that leads to more happiness. It's not clear, but it turns out this is very important. And in this study showed that this was technical competence in your boss was actually more important to job satisfaction than your pay.
So you mentioned coding. In fact, does this mean that, I mean, you're at Harvard Business School, that business schools such as HBS should be teaching aspiring tech CEOs how to code?
Maybe. They certainly would want to have the skills. I mean, if job satisfaction is important, and that does lead to higher importance, I think this study shows that's something that needs to be taken into greater account. I mean, management skills have always been important. And that's why many people have said, you know, if you have engineers, don't hire an engineer to lead them because they just won't understand how to manage them well or they won't be a good boss. But this study shows that technical competence is really important, perhaps as important as management skills.
And briefly, there's another study that bore out those findings. This one dealt with hospitals. What did it conclude?
Yeah, it concluded that hospitals that were run by physicians were 25% – performed 25% better in hospital quality scores than hospitals that were run by non-physician managers. So it shows that, you know, having having somebody at the top who understands what it's like on the front lines ends up being more important.
Yeah, gave examples of the Mayo Clinic and Cleveland Clinic. Both are run by trained physicians, and they have only been run by physicians in the past, and both are, of course, top-ranked hospitals. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, nice to have you here. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
The first order of business in the new Republican Congress and the soon-to-be Republican White House, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, or at least another attempt to repeal it. There's no clear plan to replace the law. More than 20 million Americans have health insurance through Obamacare, so dismantling it will be complicated, and it could affect health insurance for everyone. Julie Rovner is here to parse out the possibilities. Julie is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hello, Julie.
Hello, Lisa.
So, as you know, there were dueling press conferences yesterday on Capitol Hill. Republicans talking about why they want to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Democrats on why they're going to fight to keep it. One of the key elements that was brought up was the state exchanges that are part of the act. Could you briefly remind us what those are?
Yes, people who buy insurance and who want to get subsidies, want to get help buying that insurance, buy it through an exchange that has their state's name on it. Now, it's important to remember that 38 of those exchanges are actually run by the federal government through healthcare.gov. 12 states have their own exchanges. It's unclear, because it's unclear what the Republicans want to do, what will become of the exchanges, what will become of the people who purchase insurance on those exchanges, and what will become of the subsidies that they get to help them purchase insurance on those exchanges.
So the House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy from California, Republican from California, talked about the decrease in the number of insurers who are in these marketplaces, meaning these state exchanges. Let's hear from him.
But what's most concerning to so many, more than 1,022 counties across America, that's more than one third, have only one choice inside the exchanges. Everything President Obama promised about health care has failed.
That's a claim that that many would dismiss. But in the past year, insurers such as United Healthcare and Aetna have left some state exchanges. Is it true that in one third of counties nationwide, there is only one choice of an insurer?
Yes, that is true. And everybody agrees that that is a problem, although one of my colleagues here at Kaiser Health News has a story today saying that even in those places where there is only one choice of insurer, rate increases have not been really untenable. And that's partly because of the way the subsidies are structured. You're only required to pay as much as basically you can afford based on your income. But yes, everyone agrees that it's a problem, that there is so little competition and that something ought to be done to fix that.
So if Obamacare is indeed repealed, will these state exchanges disappear?
Well, that's what we don't know. I mean, the big question is about the 12 states that have their own exchanges. California, I should mention, is one of those states where things are working pretty well. Whether the states will be able to keep their exchanges remains to be seen. And as I mentioned, whether people will be able to get, you know, help paying for their insurance, because that's all federal money, that seems likely to go away if Republicans follow through on what they say they're going to do.
As you mentioned, the Democrats also had a press conference yesterday to make the case for keeping and improving the Affordable Care Act. Let's hear from House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
An increase in premiums is the lowest it has been in the 50-some years that they have been tracking that. So it has contained cost. It has increased the benefit package. And as the leader said, in terms of no discrimination in terms of pre-existing condition, no lifetime limits, no annual limits.
Julie, to what extent has the Affordable Care Act actually kept health care costs down?
Well, that is still a subject of debate. And actually, I think Leader Pelosi kind of misspoke when she said premiums have gone up at the lowest rate. But health spending overall has gone up at the lowest rate in 50 years. That's what she was talking about. And, you know, for the first couple of years, a lot of economists said, well, that was because of the recession and people lost health insurance, so they didn't spend money on health care. But since the addition of so many people under the Affordable Care Act and the improvement in the economy, health spending has continued to rise, not quite as slowly as it did in immediately following the recession, but still very slowly. And there is some evidence that some of the changes to the healthcare delivery system that were made by the Affordable Care Act are helping to sort of dampen healthcare inflation.
So if Republicans who want to get rid of Obamacare say they like certain aspects of the law, Nancy Pelosi mentioned some of those, the fact that people can't be denied insurance for pre-existing conditions, the elimination of yearly or lifetime caps on health care, might those things that benefit a lot of people be eliminated as well?
Well, it would be problematic to keep them if you take apart everything else. The idea of the Affordable Care Act was that it was, on the one hand, going to give people access to insurance who didn't have it before. And we're mostly talking about the individual insurance market, not the employer insurance market. So it's a relatively small number of people, probably 15 or 20 million people total compared to 330 million Americans. But what insurers said is that if you make us sell to sick people and you make us cover many more things, then we're going to need more healthy people to buy insurance. And that's where the individual mandate came from, that people would be required to have insurance. The Republicans want to take that away. They want to take away the help for people to pay for insurance. And what's most likely to happen is that you'll have, at that point, only sick people buying insurance. That could basically unravel the entire individual insurance market. So it's very hard to keep, you know, the candy without keeping the vegetables.
So is that why people say if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, health insurance and the cost of health care might go up for everyone?
That's exactly why.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said yesterday that if Republicans do dismantle the Affordable Care Act, it would throw an entire health care system into chaos. This refers to what you were saying there. Let's hear from him.
One of the things they'll hurt the most is rural hospitals right in their heartlands. Yeah. Okay. The minute they enact this repeal, are going to suffer dramatically. In 11 state capitals, many in red states today, rural hospitals are protesting the Republican action.
Why would that happen? Why would repealing the law hurt rural hospitals?
Well, you know, the Republicans keep talking about how there were no, you know, this was partisan and the Democrats did it without any Republican votes. But what they don't say is that the Democrats did this law with the agreement of most of the healthcare industry, particularly hospitals. And hospitals basically made a deal. They said that we will take reductions in what you pay us under Medicare, and in exchange, all these newly insured people will now have insurance when they come to the hospital. So if on the one hand you take away the people's insurance, or at least their ability to buy insurance, but you keep those Medicare cuts, which Republicans have said that they will do, then hospitals will really be in a difficult financial position. It will be more difficult for rural hospitals because they are more dependent on Medicare. So if they will not have these paying customers to offset the cuts that they agreed to take.
This gets into some of the politics involved in this discussion. To what extent are those congressmen and women who want to repeal Obamacare feeling constrained by the fact that in their districts, for example, in Ohio and Michigan, there are voters who are central to their coalition who are also dependent on the Affordable Care Act for their own health care?
Well, that kind of remains to be seen. You know, the other question is how much impact will the health industry groups have, who traditionally have had a lot of sway with Republicans. But what we've seen in a lot of states who have not expanded the Medicaid program, which became an option, hospital groups went to state houses and to governors and basically begged them to take the money. And governors and state legislatures in red states refused for ideologic reasons. So how much concern they will have. You know, they feel like they promised their voters that they would do this. The question is, did their voters realize that they were actually going to? And did some of those voters who are benefiting from this law and don't even realize it, will it be too late for them that when it goes away, they might wish that they had it?
Has it been quantified how much healthier Americans are or are not because of Obamacare?
I'm not sure we know that much about health outcomes, although, yes, there are some, outcomes that show that people are better off when they have health insurance. But certainly the number of people with insurance is at an all-time high. Conversely, the number of people without insurance is at an all-time low. And that is generally regarded as a good thing. I mean, there are a few people who wish that the government weren't so involved with it. But the general idea, even Republicans say they want everyone to have access to health insurance, if not everyone to actually have health insurance.
How much time could there be, though, before there is some, we know the repeal effort is happening now, but the replacement effort, I mean, that presumably could be a matter of months before anything moves on that.
It could be a matter of years. I mean, one of the things the Republicans are talking about, they have a lot of ideas and they have no consensus on what the replacement should look like. So they want to repeal now and then delay the effective date of the repeal while they try to find a replacement. The question is, will insurers continue to participate for that entire time, or will they just walk away and then people will be left with nothing?
Right. Some 20 million people left in the lurch, possibly?
Possibly.
Julie Rovner, who is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Nice to speak with you again, Julie. Thank you.
Nice to speak with you.
Roadways can define the places where we live. And in many cities, large and small, new road projects can cut through the city's core, sometimes taking out entire neighborhoods. That was the case with the Santa Monica Freeway in California, I-94 in Chicago, and 8 Mile Road in Detroit. It's also the case in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, 35 miles southeast of Nashville. But now, an effort is underway to undo one highway decision from the 1950s that altered the landscape and divided the city. Tony Gonzalez from Here Now contributor WPLN reports.
The Dixie Highway in Murfreesboro is locally known as Broad Street. It's 5 lanes wide and few dare to walk across it. But on a recent walking tour, a gaggle of city planners and historians uncomfortably gave it a try.
Yeah, we're going to experience the challenge of connection.
Yeah.
Right here.
Firsthand, trying to cross the street.
Right now, this is the probably single pedestrian crossway that exists across Broad Street. It's here on Church.
They laugh, but this roadway is a barrier that Murfreesboro officials now see as the enemy. It cuts off the bustling downtown square from an area known as the Historic Bottoms. On the other side, in the Bottoms, says Assistant City Manager Jennifer Moody, are warehouses, light industry, and several vacant lots.
We think it's an area that's ripe for redevelopment, and it's an area that probably would not as quickly develop on its own. So we're interested to see how public investments could encourage redevelopment faster than it would have otherwise happened.
The city is considering new infrastructure, allowing taller buildings up to 6 stories and the addition of a pedestrian bridge, all to spur private investment. The thing is, this isn't the first time the government has taken an interest in the Bottoms. Back in 1952, it was so-called Urban Renewal Federal Funds that brought the new highway through town, straight through this section. A similar project in nearby Nashville also cut through neighborhoods. To understand the impact on the community that lived here, Murfreesboro tapped local historian John Lodell. He's an expert on early African-American settlements after the Civil War.
You know, a lot of these interstates and major highways went through and cleared out slums, and predominantly African-American slums. And you see that in every major city in America.
The Bottoms was originally home to poor industrial laborers. Houses were side by side with a rail line. Lodell shows where cotton gins and sawmills once stood.
From what I'm told, the business got worse and worse, so to speak. You got into more of the saloons, gambling kind of areas coming down off the square as you got into the Bottoms.
The reputation was so rough that one funeral home worker told Lodell that he'd parked the hearse there on Friday nights just waiting for a body. Renters stayed in cramped quarters, which were flooded by a nearby creek after almost every rainfall. It can still be a little uncomfortable to talk about.
Just growing up there, you just can imagine without electricity, running water, what life could have been like down there. Very impoverished.
Few who lived in the Bottoms are alive today, but in 2002, Lodell recorded a handful of oral histories.
They were poorer than we were.
That's the late Aaron Wade Jr., an African-American whose family lived on the edges of the neighborhood.
They called them the Bottom, in the Bottoms. They lived in the Bottoms. It was a caste system in a fashion. I mean, we didn't associate with them.
Every spring, it would flood. And they'd have to move them out in boats and whatever. Family members would kind of like take them in.
Nancy Vaughn, now an author, grew up during World War II and remembers well water, an outhouse, and a kerosene stove for heat.
We didn't have a bed warmer, so I'd have to wrap them in a blanket and then run as fast as I could to get back to the back and jump in the bed because it was so cold during the winter months. But those are things that you put up with.
When the road came in, about 40 families were relocated to public housing in another part of town. Eventually, the city hall complex, a fire station, and the water department would all be built on land once home to African Americans. The Broad Street Project has a complicated legacy, says state historian Carol Van West.
It destroyed a lot of landscape and sort of divided the city. But then it did bring, you know, it did work. It brought new business into the city in a major way. So it's that sort of push-pull of urban renewal at the time.
Van West says the earnest belief was that Bottoms residents were getting an upgrade, although they weren't given much choice. Nobody lives there anymore, but there's been 9 months of public meetings about the future of the Bottoms. Kevin Gunther, an urban planner, says the city can evolve carefully.
We want to understand what happened in the past and the history of this because there's some important things there. Moving forward, we see huge opportunities. Planners, landscape architects, engineers, we think of connecting physical spaces. I think part of what we're doing is connecting the cultural understanding.
City officials expect to vote soon on plans for the Bottoms and then go about funding those improvements. For Here and Now, I'm Tony Gonzalez in Nashville.